Today's program was brought to you by Roth Cheese, a pioneer in the U.S. specialty cheese movement. For more information, visit rothcheese.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network, broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, this is Dana Cowan, and you are listening to Speaking Broadly on Heritage Radio Network. Each week, I interview fascinating people on their journeys to success. And today, my guest is Bonnie Morales, the co-owner of the revered restaurant Kachka in Portland. Bonnie, I'm so excited to see you here. I have never been to Kachka, but when I was at Food & Wine, we published your recipes. And when the team came out here to Portland, they came back and they're like, there's this person you have to meet. So it took me a while, but here we are. Welcome.
Hi, Dana. Thanks for having me.
I wanted to start out with a word. And the question is, like, at this moment in time when there's so much controversy about, you know, fact and fiction, the importance of words. And there's one word, which is the name of your restaurant, that's very important to you and has a lot of meaning. So could you start by telling us, like, what is the meaning of Kachka?
Sure, I would love to. It is a very important word to me. So Kachka just means duck. In Belarusian, in Ukrainian, apparently in Polish, also in Yiddish.
I'm assuming it's a duck and animal, not like
yes, duck. quack quack. Which is different than in Russian. In Russian, it's utka, and that's the kind of the crux of the story. When I was a little girl, my dad would tell me stories about my family that lived through the World War II, and what that meant being Jewish in Belarus and in Russia was persecution and the Holocaust. So my grandmother fled a ghetto in the middle of the night, and all her family was died the next day in a mass grave.
So she left alone.
With a 3-month-old infant, and it was October in the coldest winter in Eastern Europe's history.
And why alone?
Because her parents said, we're old, and if we all go, and there were a lot of other children in the family, if we all go, someone's going to notice. But if you go by yourself, no one will notice. And, you know, like, save yourself.
And how old was she?
I don't want to speak. Maybe 19 or 20.
Wow.
Like, young. So I picture myself as a young adult, and I could never have had that sort of bravery. But she left in the middle of the night. Everyone, in fact, was shot the next morning.
How did she find that out?
I think after the war. I don't know that that's something she found out immediately, obviously. But she traveled through the forests and headed east towards Russia, because she was in Belarus at the time. She ended up in Smolensk and fought as a partisan there. But along the way, she, you know, met a lot of people that, you know, wanted bad things to happen to her. And one of them was a town warden. She had, you know, gone into a town for provisions and all that. And this guy was like, you're a Jew. And her story at the time was that she was a Ukrainian peasant traveling to Russia to find her in-laws. He kept sort of like bugging her about that. And eventually he said, well, if you're really Ukrainian, then how do you say duck in Ukrainian? I know they're all speaking in Russian. This is Soviet Union across all of these areas, even though each country has their own native language. Everybody speaks Russian. So she just, you know, hoped that, and she spoke Yiddish at home, and she knew the Yiddish word, and there are some times when they're the same, and she just hoped that maybe this one was, and she said Kachka, and he let her go. And as a little girl, I mean, it's amazing how many stories like that she had. And then if you extrapolate that out to all of the people who went through something like this during World War II, it's just so many little chance moments. But this one particular story, maybe because it involved a duck, I don't know, when I was little, that one really stuck with me. And so that word it's just important to me.
And I on the menu, I learned so many words, right? I didn't need to read it with a dictionary because it's pretty clear what different things are. But I was I just love the fact that you didn't put everything in English, you know. And so tell me about some of the they're very romantic sounding words, like the shashlika and the, is that, did I pronounce that right?
Shashliki?
Yeah.
Like the plural of shashlik, yeah.
The skewers. And what was the choice that you made to have Russian, and is Cyrillic the...
Yeah, things are in Cyrillic for the menu, the section heads. It was a conscious decision. It wasn't just something stylistic or design based. The food that we make, and Russian I use as sort of a catch-all because my family immigrated during the Soviet Union, when it was still the Soviet Union, and so they immigrated from a place that's now called Belarus, but when they left, that didn't exist. But they also weren't Russian. But they also weren't Soviet because they were defectors. They saw themselves as Jewish, but that's not a nationality by our standards. And so it's, even me like telling people what I am is kind of a loaded question. I don't know how to answer that. So I use Russian, and a lot of people in my situation use the word Russian, but then there's a huge asterisk to that because that means Russia and all these other former Soviet republics in a lot of times. That part of the world does not get represented in the culinary world at all. And when it does, it's sort of a negative representation. There's often sort of a feeling of it being gray and drab and unhealthy. And that's so frustrating to me. So I make a point to say, no, I'm going to use the word that is Russian. Why would I use the French word? Why would I use the Italian word, right? I'm going to use the Russian word. So, you know, people say creme fraiche. Well, it's not creme fraiche. It's smetana. And it actually is different. It's different because of slightly different cultures. And people say, oh, but that's just creme fraiche. No, it's not. It's smetana. And I want you to know that word. And maybe one day people will see it as smetana first and creme fraiche second, or maybe on equal playing fields.
Another thing that comes into play there is service ruse, right? So we assume that the service style in a restaurant that we have today is French or just came out of the thin air. But in fact, it is Russian service. Do you want to talk about like what those words mean, which are said in French, actually? Right?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is that France and Russia during, you know, the 1800s and early 1900s, pre-revolution, had sort of a love affair with each other. And so many things that are sort of taken for granted in French dining actually come from Russia. And the same is true in Russia. There's a lot of stuff that's part of their dining and culinary lexicon that's actually French. And so Russian style service is one of those things. And, that's sort of the formal in a banquet setting where you're individually served. That's considered to be Russian style service. And we've taken that for granted to be this like French banquet style, and it's actually Russian. And there's so many things like that.
What are some others?
I think that blinle or blini, as people will say, are considered to be this like French caviar accompaniment. And for some reason, they're always considered to need to have potato in them. And I see that a lot in recipes that like blini equal potato pancakes. And I don't even know where that comes from. And it must be a French thing. But they're very Russian, and they're yeasted and they're delicious and they don't have potato. And so that's one that's really funny to me. I don't know. This is, I think, just on parallel, but the use of aspic in French, like sort of high French cuisine, is mirrored in Russian cooking, but it's a lot more. And I'm sure in sort of country style French, it's also very rustic, but you don't clarify, really. You make something called, for example, холодец or студен, which is where it's you're cooking some animal parts that have a higher gelatin amount anyway, and so when it's cold, it gets thick. It's a very Russian thing to make холодец, and that's with calves' feet. That's often considered, people will say, oh, that's aspic, something set in aspic. I'm like, no, it's холодец, and it's its own thing, and it has the right to be there on its own as a Russian thing, too. There's so many things like that I see.
So you've reclaimed the cuisine in a way. Did you you didn't grow up with an enormous appreciation of it, as I understand. But were you speaking Russian at home and you were eating, and was someone speaking Russian at home?
Yeah. I learned Russian first. So my parents immigrated the year before I was born, and my mom stayed home with me, and she ended up having like a Russian daycare, actually. So all the kids were other immigrants' kids. And I was sort of, patient zero in that she started staying at home because she was like, well, now I have a baby and I might as well make money while I'm doing it. So she had a Russian daycare. So in addition to learning Russian first, just because they didn't speak English, they didn't know it yet, I had all these other little friends around that were also speaking Russian. I learned English from Sesame Street and going to kindergarten. So I learned that first. But as a result, this is not a unique story, but when you are the child of immigrants in the United States, there's a huge pressure and desire, sometimes from within and sometimes from the people around you, to do what they do. I wanted nothing more than to have hamburger helper. I remember wanting to stay for dinner at my friends' houses because they would have these box dishes that I thought were so magical. And because we never had them in our house, probably because they were expensive, but also because my mom cooked and she made stuff from scratch. And I'm guessing it's because it was less expensive to do so. But either way, it was so foreign to me that that's all I wanted. And I thought it was so exotic to have these cool boxed things.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to hear more from Bonnie Morales of Kochka.
Today's program was brought to you by Roth Cheese, a pioneer in the U.S. specialty cheese movement. Roth is in its 25th year of making specialty cheese in the rolling hills of southern Wisconsin. With strong Swiss heritage, Roth is best known for its award-winning Alpine-style cheeses under the name Grand Cru. Fresh Wisconsin milk, combined with expertise in affinage, is how Roth creates high-quality, great-tasting cheese year after year. In 2016, hard work paid off when out of over 2,000 contenders, Roth Grand Cru Sirchois was named world champion at the World Cheese Championship. For more information, visit rothcheese.com.
Welcome back to Speaking Broadly on Heritage Radio Network, where Bonnie Morales is telling us about the importance of Russian food. And so now you've got these beautiful dishes on your menu that harken back to what you ate in childhood, but also true Russian food that now we can all share and appreciate. But one of the things that I was really excited about was the vodka. So last night I got to have your food for the first time at From Russia with Love, and you make a vodka with horseradish.
Yeah.
That was just off the charts. It was so great. I mean, I can't say I was in the old Soviet Union once with my grandparents in 1976.
Wow. And what a time to be there.
It was amazing. I mean, I was there with my older brother and my grandparents, and my brother snuck off with the tour guide and went drinking every night because he was 5 years older, and I was like, where'd he go? There was so much vodka and so much drinking. It wasn't quite like that last night, but it was great. And you've started a spirits company, Troika Spirits, which I'm intrigued by. Tell me about the role of spirits in this, and spirits can take a dark turn as well. And in Russia, historically, there's been, a lot of talk about how spirits can take a dark turn.
Absolutely. Yeah. For me, it's more about, and I spoke about this a little bit last night too. For me, it's more about the culture of eating and drinking together and kind of that environment, not so much about getting drunk. And obviously when alcohol is involved, it can go that way. I mean, some people take it that direction. However, it doesn't have to be that way. And I think the idea of eating and drinking and toasting and eating and doing that all together is really so critical and makes it an experience rather than an excuse to get drunk.
Let's talk about toasting.
Yeah.
Because it's a whole world unto itself. Is there a Russian style of toasting? Or how do you make a great toast?
You should bring my dad on for that question. It can be really elaborate. It can be really short and sweet. For some people, it is just an excuse to drink. And so they'll be like, yeah, let's just drink to us. And down the hatch. But especially if there's an event, like somebody's birthday or whatever, you make a point to have, like, not just here's a toast to the birthday boy, but taking the time to, like, maybe write a poem sometimes I've seen at big Russian parties, or yeah, a song even sometimes. It doesn't have to be just, like, a toast. But the idea that you've spent time to really sort of search your soul for something really meaningful is I think done more often than you normally see when people are just drinking and giving a quick toast. But in general, there's also a sense, there is some like decorum to it, where there's always a toast to the ladies, you know, because it tends to be the men who take on major drinking. But my dad always says that the toast to the ladies happens once you know you're probably going to get in trouble later. or, you know, a toast to, I said it last night, actually, this is a really common one, is a toast to everything that joins us. Mm. And I think that again, it has this like poetry to it, and it's short and sweet, but it's a nice reminder to like actually think about that thing. That seems rote, but it's not. I mean, it actually has weight to it. Yeah, there's a whole litany of them, of some that are sort of standard issue, but even those, I feel like, have this like cleverness to them. But yeah, they can be long and winding too. And it's just, the point is to make sure to say something that you really feel in the moment. And as people drink, they tend to get a little gushier, and it's a good thing. It's almost like a group therapy session.
So you were saying, you know, the things that join us, mm-hmm. You know, one of the things at this very moment in time is there's so much that divides us, and whatever part of Russia, Soviet Union, you want to consider, Russia is one of those things that divides people on how they feel about the country, how they feel about their relationship to America. And just how do you feel about that vis-a-vis the restaurant? I think so many of us feel that the restaurant and cooking has become a far more political act. And I'm just wondering how you feel about that in light of the intersection between what you're doing and today's politics.
Yeah, that's a great question. I like to remind people that the food that our people cook at home, even whoever's sort of in charge politically, is just the food that they're cooking at home. And there's, you know, the things that are happening at the Kremlin or the White House don't reflect always the people underneath them. For me, this is very personal. This is about my family. This is about their struggle and the struggles of so many other people like them. And so I that's my take on it, is that you can cook for political reasons, but so often it's brought into the picture when it shouldn't be, because at the end of the day, everybody eats, and the thing, you know, that's the thing that I want people to focus on, is the people this cuisine represents that are eating this every day, regardless of what's going on above them.
And on your menu, what are your favorite dishes? I know there's some very famous dishes, but for you, What is the dish that feels closest to home and comfort and, you know, true meaning for you? And they all have meaning for you. But.
Yeah. They do all. Like, I think that having reverence and thought behind stuff is really important. The one that's always on the menu and always will be on the menu that has probably the most significance would be golubtsy, which are cabbage rolls. And that's because, so although we do futz with some things a little bit more than others, golubtsy are something that we've made the same since day one, and it is as close to what my mom makes at home as it can be. I make a few adjustments, but one of them is there's pork and lamb in them, and she tends to make hers with chicken because that's, you know, quote unquote healthier. And she doesn't do pork really, but I do because I'm a terrible Jew. So they're that little minor difference. But besides that, they're literally how she would make them, and it's something that I, you know, as a home cook, my mom has the same like seven dishes or so that she puts on like repeat for the most part. And so, like, she's still feeding my kids when she watches them those same galupze that I, you know, had to eat when I was a kid. And, like, so those are still on the menu. If I go, if I, you know, like, come to her house, there's, you know, usually leftover cabbage rolls in the fridge.
And is she in, I mean, you grew up in Chicago.
Yeah, they moved out to Portland, though. My brother moved to Portland, and then we followed them out, him out here, because we love it so much. And then they were, my parents love it here too, but they really came for the grandkids. All of their grandchildren are here now, so they followed them out.
And is there a community for, like, a Russian community here in Portland?
There is. There's actually a massive Russian community in East Portland. It's considered, I'm not a statistician, but, you know, like, one of the largest per capita in the U.S. They're not as involved in that community. That tends to be a little bit of a different cultural subsection, but there is, like, they more affiliate with being Russian Jewish, and there is, like, a pretty large Russian Jewish population as well, and so they've got their little core group of friends.
So when you look to the future, right, you've grown so much. I mean, just as we're speaking now, you've just moved Kachka out of its space. Mm-hmm. Well, recently, mm-hmm. And then you've opened a more casual, not that place in its space.
It's more casual.
Okay. Yeah. Fair to say. I'm making faces here. They're like, is it really more casual? Because, yeah. And then you have the spirits, and then there's a deli. Like, what is in your mind, like, the biggest vision that you have of, and the biggest, like, dreamiest vision? Like,
oh, I don't know that I think that far ahead. For me, my biggest, dreamiest vision actually has nothing to do with me at all. It has more to do with the general state of Russian or Eastern European cooking in the culinary world. And that's most of the decisions that I make have to do with, does this help further that mission? Do I help? Am I helping in communicate how this food should be viewed? I want, my goal, and if I'll feel like I've really succeeded, if one day when people are like, huh, what do you want to eat tonight for dinner? And they're going through the sort of the laundry list of things you crave or think about, you know, like, let's get Thai. No, let's go get sushi. That Russian's in that mix. And, like, that's really lofty, but that hasn't not very much to do with my personal, like, you know, whether or not I have another restaurant or not. And so I often, the decisions I make, and, like, for example, writing a cookbook and things like that, often have to do with that end goal. Like, is this going to get people to consider this food in the same light as pizza and sushi? And that's what I want.
And why is that so important?
I don't know. Maybe this is just one lifelong therapy session, but it's probably has something to do with the fact that when I was a kid, I was so embarrassed of it. And, you know, being one of the things that I've, you know, as every year that goes by, you're more of an adult, and, you know, you get to this point of, like, I don't care anymore. I don't care what people think about me. And that's, like, that's the most freeing thing. You're nodding your head because it's so true.
It's so true.
And so, like, you know, you get
it's everyone's goal, right?
Right. And so I really don't care what people think about this food, or I'm not embarrassed, I should say. I don't care about that. I'll eat it. I love it. I'll tell you how much I love it. I love kaladets, meat jello, essentially. You know, like, that's something that I would never have said before. And so that's that. I feel like I'm on this mission because I am, like, making up for all that time as a kid where I was, like, hiding it and being embarrassed of it.
One last question. Is there a woman who is working in the world of food or spirits or hospitality who you admire, where you'd want to pay it forward? Like, they're amazing. We should all know about her.
I don't have to go very far. I think what Katie Millard is doing at Coquine is really respectable. Because I have kids, but my parents are here, I have, like, a very, I totally understand. So she has a little boy, and she has one of the best restaurants in the country, definitely the best restaurant in Portland. And I love what she does so much that every time I eat something at her restaurant, it's like, not only is it good, but I'm like, this is exactly what I wish that I would have thought to do here. You know, there's very little chance that it's not just exactly what I want. And so maybe we're just on the same wavelength, because obviously food's very personal, but I appreciate what she does so much. And I know how hard she works, and I know how hard it is to do a small, yeah, it's her husband runs the dining room, so it's also, we have the same sort of setup, but they don't have the support that we do with that they have with their kids. So it's just, I know what she's going through, and I feel like I'm so amazed and impressed that she could execute on that level with having that much stress. I think it's amazing.
And with that, I just want to thank you so much, Bonnie, for joining me today. And I want to thank Travel Portland, Stream PDX, and the Julia Child Foundation for making our coverage of Feast possible. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Speaking Broadly. If you like what you hear, please subscribe on Stitcher or iTunes. I want to thank Bonnie Morales for sharing her heart and her stories about food and Russia. I hope that all of you who are listening are going to go out and search out some dumplings, some flavored vodkas, and make a toast to a good friend. You guys know where to find me if you want to send suggestions, ideas, compliments, comments, or criticisms. You can send it to FW Scout on Instagram and Twitter. And I want to thank my engineer of the day, Vitor. Look forward to having you all back next week. Have a great week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.